Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is February 28, 2019. A number of topics tonight dealing with weather, something that I know a little bit about, having written probably the premier book over the last 100 years on the topic, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, actually published in around 2005, I think was the publication date. And it is still the premier book. And I have to say this, that standard science has not caught up yet. In fact, you almost would think they're purposefully ignorant. But as long as they can keep saying El Nino or La Nina or solar vortex or polar vortex or double wall hurricane, double eye wall hurricane, all of the buzzwords that they've created to wow you, the public, as long as they can keep doing that, they can keep the facade up that somehow they know something when, in fact, they don't. But just along that same line, NASA this past week, as this was sent in by a listener, they're showing the amazing auroras in Iceland, which in a sense is not amazing because they have auroras literally nightly. When you get that far north, up around the Arctic Circle, there's literally auroras going on all the time. And remember, at this time of year, those areas of the planet are facing away from the sun. So north of the Arctic Circle, you have the 24-hour nighttime, you know, as opposed to the summertime when they're getting 24-hour days. Right now, the South Pole is in summer. So the North Pole is in basically nighttime. And so these amazing auroras, but the problem is there is no solar activity commensurate with that level of auroral activity. So there's very little going on in terms of the sun. And when they talk about flares, they're talking about G1 flares. This is the lowest level of measurement of solar flaring that is possible. There's the G, then it goes up to M and X-class flares, etc. We have not seen an X-class flare in almost 15, maybe 15 years. It might have been a little activity. But basically, Hale-Bopp has diminished when it was in the solar system up until around the year 2002 when it finally left. It was basically discharging the solar capacitor, and that energy goes into the formation of the planet. It's kind of like having a baby in a sense, although I've never had a baby myself. I wouldn't be able to speak from experience, but lots of women have, and it takes a lot of energy. They have to eat extra, they have to exercise and be in good physical condition, etc. And having a baby takes a lot of extra energy. And so creating a planet, it's not free. So that energy has to come from someplace. And this idea that NASA tries to put out that these things just collapsed all by themselves, and then all of a sudden you got oceans, and then you got atmospheres, and then you got people walking around, that just is all happened by itself, is ludicrous, nonsense. It takes energy to form a planet, and a lot of the chemicals that are in the planet took energy to form also from the raw material, the oxygens and hydrogens and the calciums and the irons and the potassiums and the calcium. Did I say that already? At least all of these materials had to join, and that's where the comet comes in. As these materials come together and in the discharge of the solar capacitor, that requires energy. This is not free. This is, you know, they can draw a picture in a book. That's free, but it's wrong. It doesn't make any sense. You have to account for the energy. So anyway, back to the auroras in Iceland, that these tremendous aurorals occurring, but there's no solar activity. So where is the energy that is being expended, where does it come from, that creates these amazing auroral displays? And it turns out, as I explain in my weather book, there are two return current sheets that act around our sun. One is in the month of August, and then you go 6 months around the year, and that leads us up to February, where we are right now. And so and this was the original point I started talking about, the north pole of the Earth being in nighttime. So that's on the tail side of Earth. And so that's why it's getting interaction from the return current sheet that is in the solar system that we pass through approximately in the month of February. And that's, by the way, why February turns out to be one of the biggest storm months and aurora months. So there's no great surprise here if you understand the cause and effect. But if you're a standard scientist and you're thinking that the solar wind creates auroras and only solar wind, then you're going to be left without an answer. There are other things that can happen that can cause auroras. For example, a new moon. Right now, a number of days ago, we passed through the full moon, which means that the moon is back behind us on the non-sunward side. And so that, along with the new moon, or the new moon passing, as I call it, where the new moon passes away from in front of the Earth, then those have effects also. Or if we have an electrical planetary alignment, or if we have an electrical cometary alignment with Earth, those can all create auroras also. In fact, let's go back a few thousand years, where Venus, the comet, was coming through the solar system, and as it approached Mars, the ancients talk about this, and there's rock paintings. The cover of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, has an Indian rock painting that signifies this event, where the snake-like protrusion, electrical discharge from the comet Venus, reached out, and it looked as if there was a snake holding Mars in its jaws. And that's the symbolism that we get from all over the world, that in the jaws wrapping around the planet Mars were actually a massive, massive auroras that were displayed up in the upper atmosphere before that atmosphere was literally sucked away. Now, it was not the electrical current that sucked it away. It was the action of the fact that Mars' surface gravity was less than that of the passing comet nucleus Venus, the comet stage. And so that was instrumental in who won the tug of war over the atmospheres, etc. And so at any rate, but there's also, I should clarify this, the negatively charged comet, as soon as that material on Mars in the atmosphere or in the oceans became ionized, okay, now that's a different story. Then you have the ion attraction, which is tremendously strong compared to the gravitational attraction, and that would likewise take that atmosphere and suck it off of Mars right now. And then you ask, well, why didn't that happen with Earth? And the actual answer is that we did have an interaction with the comet Venus, but Earth had a tremendous pollution event. In other words, Earth won the tug of war off this material. So anyway, back to the auroras in Iceland that were reported this past week. It is because we are in the return current sheet that we pass through, that Earth passes through, in the month of February. Now, this, a couple days ago, people wrote to me from the upper Midwest. I have people that I talk to from the Pacific Northwest, etc., where they are having tremendous snow activity and weather activity that just shut things down. But Minnesota, apparently, a place that's where I grew up as a kid. Grew up in Minnesota. And they just announced that Minnesota surpassed the all-time historical record for snow and cold. So this has been, if you happen to be up in the Midwest or any of the states, even down as far as Florida, you experience some tremendous weather this year. Cold weather, wind, snow, and cold weather. Just dropping temperatures, extreme cold temperatures, where the people just basically locked themselves in their house. I was on John Moore's show yesterday, and a guest called in from West Virginia, and they had been out of electricity, some of them for weeks, because of the harsh weather. But at any rate, I just wanted to mention a few other kind of fun facts here. Las Vegas, a place we typically associate with 105 degree weather. The last time I was in Las Vegas, I had a business meeting there, and it was quite a few years ago, but it was, as I recall, about 105, and the poor little rental car air conditioner could not keep up with it. And so it was about 80 in the car, but it was much more comfortable than 105 outside. But sunny Las Vegas had 3 inches of snow this about a week ago. And Maui, the Hawaiian island of Maui, had snow on Haleakala, which is the big mountain, I believe it's on the eastern lobe. There's two lobes that make up Maui. On the eastern lobe, the central mountain there is a volcano called Haleakala. And they had snow down to as far as 6,000 feet above sea level. So from 6,000 feet above sea level up to the mountaintop was covered with snow. So we have it snowing in Hawaii, which is not completely unusual. Haleakala and then also the Big Island of Hawaii has two volcanic mountains that go way up, and typically in the winter they will sport a coating of white snow up at the top. But to have it on Maui, where the snow came down to 6,000 foot above sea level, to that level is truly amazing. So, but just wanted to mention too that in Minnesota, okay, so this is 2019, we're talking about 1962 in Minnesota. I was a kid, and I was I would have been 14 years old at that point. And I remember that winter. So that was the last winter that had broken all of the records for snow, cold, temperature, everything. And just breaking that record, all-time record. And it's, by the way, it's only February. They have March. March is the snowiest month of the year in Minnesota, and April can also have quite a bit of snow. A couple years ago, it was about 6-7 years ago, it snowed all the way into May and had record snows of in May of that year in Minnesota. So, you know, life can be brutal there. But 57 years ago, when 1962, when the previous Minnesota all-time snow, cold, terrible weather record was set, I happened to be a kid there. And I would go out, you know, I got climatized to the point where I could go out in just a shirt. And I would take my shovel, my trusty shovel. I had two shovels, a push shovel. But that was no good when you had that much snow. That was only good when you had a couple inches of snow. And anyway, I would remember standing there in one spot, shoveling like a foot at a time down, and there would be literally 4 or 5 feet of snow that would fall overnight, and then the next day it would again. I mean, there was hardly any place to put it. I had to throw that snow up and over a bank, and then you'd shovel the next foot, and then the next foot, and then the next foot, till you got down to the sidewalk or the driveway or whatever you were shoveling, and then you could move and shovel the next little piece. And I went up and down the street with my shovel and knocked on the door, "Can I shovel your sidewalk?" and lots of people there was like, you know, what do you charge? It's like $5 or $10, which was 1962. That was pretty good money for just a kid down the street, you know, just beginning. At that point, I was just beginning high school, to give you an idea. Well, 14 years old, I guess so. But I would shovel, and I'd walk up to the house and knock on the door. Can I shovel your sidewalk? And the people would look at the sidewalk that they couldn't see. It was covered with 4 or 5 feet of snow. And they'd think about $10 or whatever. And that was an easy sale, believe me. Because if I didn't do it, that was before snow blowers, by the way. The snow blowers did not come along until after that. So me and my trusty shovel made quite a bit of money that winter. That provided me with spending money that tremendously harsh winter, and also gave me a lot of good exercise. But be that as it may, here we are, 2019, 57 years later, finally breaking that record. And no, I did not get to experience it this year, thank goodness. I know people who are there, I get comments now and then, people that still live there, and oh my goodness. Yes, harsh weather. And up to the last question, the question of the hour, is we've all heard this term polar vortex, which is a sexy term created by the news media to wow the public. And have there been polar vortexes previously? Yes, throughout history. A polar vortex is nothing more than a himmicane, a overland hurricane that sits there, and as the northern polar jet stream comes around, it goes around, excuse me, in an easterly direction as it comes around, and it hits that polar vortex, which is going in the counterclockwise direction. It drags that jet stream from around the polar area and sends it down across Canada and into the northern states. And it can push all the way down to Cuba. In the past, I remember a number of years ago, Cuba actually had people dying because of the cold. Florida was tremendously cold. It was a danger to the citrus crop, etc., in Florida. But the question now is this polar vortex, is this man-made? And the answer is, I don't know if it is, but it could be. It would be very easy to manipulate this and create a weather system that would drag that cold weather down and consistently do that. And so the question then would be, who's doing this? Is it like, you know, from a James Bond movie, somebody that's got a laser satellite and they're creating the weather? Is it the deep state in the U.S.? Could it be the Russians? How about the Chinese? Maybe the North Koreans? Maybe Iran? You know, we just, you know, anyway. I don't know, but it's not out of the realm of natural weather to have this going on. But on the other hand, it's something that very easily could be manipulated and created. And when here's the thing, whenever I see the weather media coming out with something like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, when the hurricane started to come in regularly this 2 years ago, was it 2 years ago when Irma and Maria and the Puerto Rico, all those storms were coming into the Caribbean, all of them manipulated, I had made a point to show that the northwest or the leading edge of the eye wall got stretched out, and they could sometimes actually make two walls because of the laser satellites dragging that hurricane, pumping it up in energy, and dragging it along in the direction they wanted it to go. And so then they got the news media, the weather news media, to come out and say, oh, that's a double eye wall. In other words, they had the news media create a term to make you think that is normal. And I'm sorry, but after studying hurricanes for a good part of my life and looking at tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of videos and photographs of hurricanes, there had never been double eye walls before. So why all of a sudden, starting in the year 2000, about year 2001, did we start having double eyewall hurricanes? Well, that's about the time the laser satellites first started going up and creating weather manipulation and hurricane manipulation. So back to the issue of polar vortex. Were the polar vortex phenomena created it? Did they give the weather media some kind of sexy term so that they could throw that out there and make everybody think that this is something new? And the implication, by the way, it was subtle, it was there, that this was somehow related to global warming. Now, if you can imagine that this year has anything to do with global warming, you are smoking some of that funny stuff. Anyway, anybody who still thinks there's global warming or global climate change due to man-made events is, you know, there's no science. There was never any science. It's what we call in science fear porn. And that's by hyping up and this idea that there's universal agreement simply as a result that back in the, it was in the 90s when I started talking about this, I said this global climate change and all of this, at that time they called it the greenhouse effect, which they stopped using because the greenhouse effect doesn't work. In a nutshell, Venus has thousands of times more carbon dioxide and the greenhouse effect doesn't work there. So how could it possibly work on Earth? Well, it doesn't. And so anyway, The bottom line is, and for those people who still want to think that, here's what I tell people that believe in climate change. They have jumped on and bit the biggest hook in history. But here's the hook. Here's the real hook. Has their 30 years of jumping up and down and screaming and saying we all got to do stuff and trying to pass legislation and installing solar panels that don't work, has it done anything? Do we consume less oil? Do we consume less nuclear fuel? Do we consume less coal? And the answer is no. So the real answer is that global climate change and all the jumping up and down is all about something, and it's very subtle. Now understand this. It's something that's going to happen in 20 years from now. So the average activist can jump up and down now about what's going to happen in 20 years, but the average businessman does not give a rat's, you know what, because it doesn't affect his pocketbook right now. I saw the Crazy Eyes Cortez woman, the New York dizzy chick that got elected to be the senator up there, representative, said that it's legitimate not to have children because of global climate fear. Now, excuse me, there again, why don't you tell that to the people in China or India or Kuala Lumpur or Sierra Leone, where they have in spite of a 50% mortality rate of babies up to the age of three, in a 75% mortality rate up to the age of 10, and they're still doubling their population every 10 years or more in some cases, why don't we send Google Eyes Cortez over to India in those other countries and see if she can explain it to them? Because we don't have a local population growth problem in the United States. In fact, if it were not for the illegal alien population, which is growing by leaps and bounds, the United States is actually losing population. So anyway, back to the issue of global climate change and the politics of that. This is a political ruse that was meant to activate people so they could march down the wrong road and not accomplish anything. And that's exactly what has happened. And do you know how many people who are sincere, they are, you know, they try to do their homework. They're not good scientists, the vast majority of them. And they have infiltrated the textbooks with this and the schools and tried to pound it down the students' throats, etc. But there's no science here. And I explain this very frequently. It's very simple. Temperature is not a measure of global climate. Climate meaning heat content. So if you're talking about heat content, measuring temperature has almost nothing to do with it. And if you measure the air temperature, it has almost nothing to do with it, because the majority of heat content on Earth is not in the air. It's in the earth. It's in the oceans. We're more than 3/4% ocean in terms of the heat. In fact, in terms of heat content, the atmosphere, if you take the heat content, the entire heat content of the atmosphere of Earth and compare it to just a little bit of the oceans, the ocean heat content dwarfs that of the atmosphere. So by measuring the temperature of the atmosphere, you are not at all measuring the heat content or the change in heat content of Earth. So bad, bad, bad science heaped on bad science, heaped on scientific fear porn, that's the term we use because that's the only thing you can call it, has created a completely political scenario. And you look at the people who are pushing this, even if you believe in it and you're just convinced beyond, you know, any doubt, and that it's, you know, you're absolutely convinced, number one, it's being used for political purposes, to tax people, to to create government control scenarios. It's used to control water where people do not have water resources. It's used for all kinds of nefarious purposes, and it has not accomplished its main goal of trying to reduce carbon footprint. That is the bottom line. Of 30 years of jumping up and down and crying wolf, it hasn't accomplished anything, and it's not going to accomplish anything. So anyway, back to the idea of snow and weather control, etc. There's really no way to know for sure, you know, being mere mortals down here, I don't have instrumentation up near the North Pole to know if those vortices, they're really not vortices. A vortex is really a misnomer. We're dealing with cyclonic. Cyclonic is storms. It's a better term, because the vortice is a term that's typically used in a bathroom, in a bathtub scenario. And the cyclonic storms are very much different. It's a very subtle, it's a subtlety in terminology, but we're not talking about vortices here, although in a sense you could say a vortice is the same thing as a cyclonic movement. But not really. If you come down to it, what we're really dealing here with is a cyclonic storm. And the possibility that those are man-made, yes, they certainly could be. Would I put it past anybody, including people in the United States? No, I wouldn't put it past anybody. And the levels that, you know, that are out there with access to that equipment. Okay. On to the next topic here. Now, this is, I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes, but this is a growing concern. There's a lot of people out there, including myself, who don't believe in vaccinations. And the reason is the if you look at what a vaccination does, it takes a live virus and you have not one but three or four of these. Part of the issue here is in a vaccination, you don't just get the vaccination, you get a lot more. You get mercury, you get aluminum, you get other chemicals that are extremely damaging the human body and nervous system. And there's a good association that a lot of the problems that kids have growing up today, the medical problems, autism, and other issues with kids are caused by the shots. But be that as it may, and there's all kinds of contradictions. For example, if those people who have their kids vaccinated really believe in the shots, that they are protecting their kids, then there should be no issue, because if your kid comes in with measles and this kid over here is vaccinated for measles, then he should have no problem at all because he is vaccinated. And so anyway, there's all kinds of basically bad science and fake studies out there, potentially on both sides of this issue. And once again, it's a very heated issue. There are now 17 states that allow people to opt out of vaccinations. In other words, if you bring your kids to a school and want them to enter and they've not been vaccinated, you can sign a waiver saying you're not going to have your kids vaccinated, and then they have to let the kids go to school. But of course, there's a lot of pressure from the schools, from the school boards, from the government, etc. And of course, this is big pharma that is behind this. Now, if the CDC, or the Center for Disease Control, and the World Health Organization, WHO, which is a good mnemonic, because you really wonder who is running this world, it's the pharmaceutical companies. But if they were doing their job, here's what they would do to eradicate disease. First of all, they wouldn't let unabashed immigration into the country. They would be the first one at the border saying, you can't come into this country unless you have proper medical documentation. So let us look at a number of these so-called diseases like measles and mumps. Mumps is where your neck glands swell up. And now, I happen to have had both of these when I was a kid. And I had other things. And let me tell you what would happen when I was a kid. And before me, if some kid would get measles or mumps, the moms would notify each other and they'd bring the kids over to the house, where the kid had measles or mumps or chickenpox. And they let the kids play together until they all got it. That is how they built up immunity in the kids. And once you got it, and here's the issue. Here's why you want the kids to have the disease when they're kids. And it isn't fun, but those diseases, if you get them as adults, are much worse. Much worse. And so the idea that you can vaccinate kids and vaccinate this away, the other thing that there are some diseases that you really do not want to get, including, I'm not going to go into specifics on this because I don't want to get into an argument with people who are medical doctors, etc. But there's things that, in a sense, you do not want to get. But the way you deal with those, let me use one that's been pretty much eradicated. It's called leprosy. Something that if you get that, you know, it's really not a cure for it, even with modern day antibiotics, etc. And so what you do is you isolate the people. You have a quarantine, it is called. Okay, so with a quarantine, then only the people there are going to have it. And that's, in fact, there's still leper colonies in the world, and it's a disease that was eradicated by quarantine. But the CDC and the WHO and the other health organizations don't want to do that. They have become convinced that shots are the way to go, immunization. The problem is, because of the fervor over immunization, they're now giving babies 10 shots when they're very little. And the babies' bodies cannot handle this. There's a syndrome, it's called sudden infant death syndrome, called SIDS. And that's a kind of a catch-all phrase for babies that die, especially from vaccination. If you take your baby in, get him vaccinated, and the baby ends up dying, they call it SIDS. That's just like a paintbrush, big broad stroke. Everybody falls in that category. Kids, all babies that die, are due to SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. You know, and of course, babies are delicate, and so they can die from all kinds of causes. But nobody's doing statistical studies on this. There are parents that are just beginning to realize that they have been conned by the pharmaceutical medical industry in having their babies immunized to this level, and is having drastic effects on the babies. So they're giving more shots, they're giving them at a younger age, and there's more and more pressure from schools. And of course, kids are going to, for example, daycare. And so daycare institutions or situations like that, where the state will come in also and say, oh, you can't bring your kids around any other kids unless they've been immunized. And then you have that stigma once again. Oh, you're bringing your sick kids into our environment. This is the real only reason I'm mentioning this is because this is an issue that's really heating up. You're going to hear a lot more about this. It would be good for you to become educated, and especially if your parents or new parents or expecting to be new parents especially, start to get wise about this, because once you start sticking needles in those babies, it's a one-way process. There's no way to undo that or the harm that's done to those kids as they grow up. So anyway, all I'm saying is I'm not a doctor. I don't have investments in big pharma. And when I was a kid, I did not have immunization, and I'm as healthy as can be. I had some of those childhood diseases. And I remember meeting people who were adults who did not have some of those, and they had very severe complications when they were older, when they had, for example, rickets and other adult type of nervous system disorders, very debilitating because the adults did not have those when they were little kids. So there's more than one side to this coin. That's all I'm telling you. And this issue is going to heat up. And of course, Big Pharma has, it's very strange, Big Pharma has more influence in Washington, D.C., more lobbyists, etc., than the military-industrial complex. But of course, those people have their skids greased in Congress because that's mainly what Congress does, is appropriate military spending. That's an easy sell. You don't need many lobbyists. You just the question is not if the money is going to be spent. The question is which companies are going to get the money. And here's a topic that I breached on John Moore's show yesterday morning when I was a guest. And I have talked about this before. And so I'm going to have to be very careful the way I actually lay this out. And it's kind of like I have a public statement on my webpage. Did NASA go to the moon? And of course, that's one of the big questions. And there's arguments in favor and arguments against. And that could go on forever, you know, with all kinds of studies or whatever. But the end result is, and this is as a scientist, I put a statement on my webpage with my official response to this, and it is very simple. It is that NASA has made an unverified scientific claim. In the world of science, you don't get to verify your very own claims. It has to be cross-checked by other people and verified by other independent parties, people that don't have an axe to grind, people that don't have a financial or other monopolistic interest in this topic. NASA is the only one that's ever told us that they went to the moon and landed men there and brought them back. NASA is the sole provider of that claim. And there's no corroborating claim that has ever surfaced. It's always NASA, NASA's buddy, the University of Arizona Astronomy Department, or whatever it is. It's always that clique of people that have a vested interest in coming up with the same answer. On the Challenger accident, the Challenger space shuttle accident, there is a similar issue. And it is very simply, there's no evidence. I mean, we all saw it blow up. We all saw all the astronauts marching down, waving as they walked off to get into the space shuttle Challenger. But we don't know. There's no evidence that suggests that those people really were on that spaceship and that they died. There is, and the entire follow-up of the recovery, etc., is completely mired in improbable, and the only thing you can say is that the standard procedures that should have been followed were simply not followed. And you could talk about all kinds of other so-called conspiracy theories. Well, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a fact that there's no evidence that allows us as the public to believe that those people died in that accident. And the other question was it even an accident? And here is the clear and present danger in accepting these kinds of stories. Now, am I saying that nobody died there? No, don't misquote me. I'm saying there is no evidence presented to the public, real evidence, that those seven people died on that spacecraft that blew up in front of everybody's eyes. And here's the entire issue, if you take it from the very beginning. NASA goes out and says, we want to publicize the great things we're doing in space. And the best way to do this would be to have a competition all over the United States where kids would recommend their science teacher to go into space. So NASA begins this national competition, big red letters everywhere, all the schools nominate your teacher to go into space with NASA. And so then, you know, the kids write and they do all this, and this is all very much kid participation. So let's put it this way. There wasn't a kid in the country age 1 or age 5 or 6, you know, first grade, up to whatever level in high school that wasn't aware of this program. Every kid was aware of it. And during the time that it was going on, some kids would have graduated from high school and got into college, you know, that age, or were off working after high school or whatever. And so there was vast, vast awareness of this program, universal awareness of this program amongst the youth of the country. And all this going on, and whenever I see one of these things, you know, I always think in the back of my head, there's something going on here, but it, you know, you feign to say things like that. But anyway, okay, this process goes on, and then they have levels of selection and finalists, and then, you know, and throughout this whole process, there's tremendous amount of hoopla, feedback to the kids, and they finally select Christy McCullough. And, oh, she's a woman teacher, and, you know, she has all the things that, you know, just so she goes off and becomes trained as an astronaut. Finally, the big day of the launch comes. She walks down the plank with the other six astronauts, and boy, do they have them waving. It's just a big photo op with them walking down, and you can see this over and over and over again. That these people are walking out there. Yep, there they go. They're walking out to get on that space shuttle and go off into space, the teacher. And now the thing doesn't blow up high up in the air. It's very much invisible range. So the thing takes off and it's going up, you know, I don't know how many minutes into the flight, but it's right there. The parents are there. There are teachers there. There's all kinds of invited people there down at the Cape to watch this thing go off. And boom, in front of everybody, that baby goes up in smoke. Now, we are told all kinds of stories. It comes down to the very simple question. Were those seven astronauts on that spacecraft when it blew up? And if they were, then no question about it, they died. And of course, I heard the story, you've heard it, that they were alive during the descent. Some of them turned on their gas and eventually would have died when they hit the water. Something, by the way, that I openly criticized NASA when they were building the shuttle program. I said, you did not provide these people with some kind of escape plan. If that rocket blows up, all you need, because the crew quarters was a completely separate module that sat in a very loose housing up in the front. And, of course, all of the pressure when you are decelerating to come back in, or if you're going up, all the pressure is from the back. So it was just sitting there. And, of course, when the explosion occurred, the space container, the crew container, just went blasting out the front of the space shuttle. And it would have been easy to give them a parachute and they would have all lived. But NASA didn't do that. I mean, it was such an inexpensive addition that all of the crew members would have easily survived that accident. And with the amount of fuel you have there, you can only imagine. Now, the Saturn V system had an escape rocket that if something happened to the main rocket, they had a little teeny rocket, if you remember, up on the nose of the Apollo and on the Geminis also, they had a little rocket that would take that space capsule and take it up high enough where they could open a parachute and come back down safely. Okay, be that as it may, NASA did not provide that. And so we hear all of these various stories, etc. But the question is, NASA has never provided real evidence that people died in that accident. And very simply, there's other cases like the 9/11 plane in Pennsylvania. There's no bodies that were ever recovered. If you have an air accident, there are bodies that there's something there that can be identified, etc. With the space shuttle, NASA has never presented anything that would allow the public to decide for themselves that this really happened. And what is the end result? Here's the point of all of this. What is the message? Well, first of all, every kid in grade school and in high school and probably in college and people who were out working after high school who had been associated and very much exposed to this teacher in space program. Everybody was watching and all their parents. So, we had a captive audience of probably 200 million people watching that shuttle go off. Now, what is the subtle message that comes back here? It's not so subtle. The subtle message is you cannot go into space. And they had, it may have been the intention of this program all along. But the end result is NASA can only go into space, and it's even dangerous for them, and only qualified people, etc. And then at that point, the space program shut down. And everybody basically, if NASA would have provided them parachutes, they would have floated down to Earth, they would have been saved, and all we had to do is come on with another shuttle and, maybe fix a few things, but it would not have caused this tremendous shutdown of the entire space program. But as a result, we still live in this world where going into space is the realm of the government, of the big boys, and the federal control of the Federal Aviation Administration now moving in to control because it's so dangerous. At any rate, and all I'm saying is that NASA has never presented any evidence. And I believe it'd be a little bit too late to try and come up with something now other than the standard rhetoric that, you know, we all saw this thing blow up. Yeah, we saw it blow up. We saw the people, the astronauts, walk down the ramp, all waving. You know, yeah, they looked like they were going to get on the space shuttle. But there's no evidence that they did. There's no evidence that they died. There was no evidence that was anybody on that shuttle. And everything that should have happened after that did not happen. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to post it on my webpage. It's unfortunate I have to spend time on my radio show discussing these issues, but these are major issues because the entire nation's future in space depended on the success of that teacher going into space, and it did not happen. And there's no evidence that that teacher died, just like from 9/11. We have a lot of people. There's no evidence of those people dying. There's not a shred of evidence that there was anybody on the airplanes or anything. We have absolutely zero evidence of people in those four planes that supposedly died. There's not a shred of evidence left over from any of those that involved people that allegedly died. You might say, well, why am I talking about this? It doesn't buy me anything. It doesn't help my cause. This is talking about, this is not something that's beneficial to me. But in the world of standard science, science needs to have a reality check. It has to have realism. And there is no realism in this, in these stories. And anyway, it's a sad situation. It's a tremendously sad situation. A topic that's somewhat akin to this, which I talk about now and then, is called peer review, where when peer review started 150, probably much longer ago, when people were publishing scholarly articles in mathematics and science, etc., there was peer review. And then in a lot of those cases, like Newton and a lot of those other people that published tremendous volumes, did not submit for peer review of any kind. They just realized they were creating new work and they put that out there. And it's the basis for a lot of the science and mathematics that we use today. But peer review has turned into something very different today. The fact that that science has a lot of money at stake. In fact, mathematics is entering that world also, where there's a lot of influence, political influence. And this has degraded the world of peer review. Another thing that has come in to play is that government funding is the thing that moves peer review, and it's a cycle of publish or perish, of submitting articles for peer review, the authors not owning their work, and then the cycle of government funding that comes back around and keeps this loop moving with the National Science Foundation or National Institute of Health or NASA or other government agencies. But remember that real science, if you look at all of the work that's done, for example, in the military-industrial complex, none of that work is published in peer-reviewed journals. None of it. Absolutely none. So the amount of material that actually gets published in peer-reviewed journals is really minute compared to the amount of engineering, et cetera, that goes on these days. I have a subpage on my webpage. It's called A Criticism of Peer Review, And the issue is that, well, just go read that. That somewhat speaks for itself. Just a few minutes left here in this show. Just remember, I have a new release out. Go to my webpage. This past week, I was really busy, so I did not get to update my webpage at all. I should be able to get that done very soon here. And remember, there's a 10% sale on all the water filter products. My GF water filter elements fit any of the standard water filters out there, the gravity feed water filters, 10% sale. They take out arsenic and fluoride in the main filter. You do not need add-on filters. They take out chlorine, fluoride, arsenic, chloramines, and a very, very long list, the entire list of organic chemicals, etc., that are removed in these filters is listed. And 10% sale, and I still have free shipping, although shipping is eating me alive lately. I believe that that's something that I can do. If you purchase from me, you get free shipping, so you don't have to drive to the store. It just comes to your door, and there it is. Also, remember, I have the new MR7. I'm very excited about this, the MR7 whole house water filter. And these are flow rates, standard flow rates up to 12 gallons per minute, and removing up to 99% of the chemicals. So these have the same chemical removal and bad stuff removal as my standard gravity feed GF filters, but they're big. They come in a housing that is for the whole house for high flow rates, and they last just about forever. And so like 50 to 100,000 gallons, this is for the whole house. Now, why would you want one of these? Well, basically, when you turn on the shower and get in that shower, you're taking a nice hot shower, all of that steam, in that steam is chlorine and fluoride and arsenic and chloramine and all of the other stuff that's in the water table, pharmaceuticals. And you're showering in this and breathing it. And there's no question that cancer has taken over in the United States as the number one killer of adults before heart disease. That means people are dying of cancer before they get old enough to die from heart disease. A horrific situation. So in water, polluted water that comes from the city or from your own well, you got to get that water purified before you drink it. It's a matter of health, literally. And then your whole kitchen, everything you do in the kitchen or in the bathroom sink. And by the way, your clothes, when you see all of that dust in your clothes, the lint, that's because of chlorine. It's destroying your clothes. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and see all of this. It's on the sales page. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.